welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Fireside Room, we have Steve O'Neill, and he will be speaking on homelessness and housing. What can you do? So, let's listen in on Steve.
I wanted to start by just telling a couple quick stories about homeless people that I've known. About 7 years, I've lived in homeless shelters, about 2 years in Washington, D.C., just a few blocks from the Capitol, part of the Community for Creative Nonviolence, a group that started in the 1970s and has operated various shelters and programs for homeless people since that time. Angie and I lived in a shelter for about 16, 17 people in the northwest part of inner city D.C. It was a shelter for acutely ill homeless people, people who were coming out of the hospital and had no place to go except back on the streets. And then we, the last 5 years, we've lived in a hospitality house in Duluth, Minnesota, part of the Loaves and Fishes community, a Catholic worker community, not really Catholic by institutional Catholic, but a Christian community that's provides shelter to homeless people and refugees and so on, but mostly homeless people. I'd like to start by talking about John. John was a guest with us about 2 years ago, a very talented carpenter, wonderful carpenter. He'd been a carpenter as his father had, and started his carpentry when he was a young boy and got better and better. And would go back and forth from northern Minnesota to Texas. In the summer, he would be up in Minnesota, in the winter, he'd be down in Texas, building houses, building shopping centers and so on, but mostly building custom-designed houses, cabins up in northern Minnesota. And he could build cabinetry and everything. Very talented, but unfortunately, in his teenage years, he started drinking heavily and using drugs heavily, and to keep that habit going, got in trouble with the law, wound up in jail, and in and out of jail, in and out of programs for alcoholism, and eventually lost all of his tools, and I wouldn't say he lost his ability to do his trade. I mean, while he was drinking heavily, he did, or using heavily, but found himself out on the street. A couple times in his life, he would sober up and get things back together and get back to work and buy back tools and go back to work. And we ran into him one of these times. He was just coming out of a detox, out of a detoxification program. That's where people who are kind of found drunk on the streets or in some public place are usually kind of hauled into. And John was referred to us by the folks at Detox, and we get a lot of people from there. And he spent about 2.5-3 months with us, stayed sober, got a job, did a tremendous amount of volunteering around in our community and working for a nonprofit land trust that's building houses for low-income people. And very skilled, did a lot of wonderful work. And unfortunately, after about 3 months, and when things seemed to be coming together for him, he has tools back and so on, started to reestablish his relationship with his mother. His father had drowned while drinking several years before. He started drinking again and moved back out in the streets. And about 6 weeks later, he drowned in about 5 feet of water. He was an excellent swimmer. Very drunk. The second person, Kevin, lived with us about 4 years ago. Kevin was also an alcoholic, a young man. John was in his mid-30s, Kevin was in his mid-20s. Kevin had been a manager of a number of kind of fast food places in and around Duluth, Superior, native of the area. And he had done pretty well, and unfortunately his drinking usually would cause him to lose his job. And he'd lose the job and then he'd straighten out and kind of get back. And Most of the time he was able to keep a relationship with his family and friends. But after a while, he lost those relationships. And again, you know, somebody who found himself kind of on the edge of being out on the street. He actually wasn't probably out on the street, but he had no place to go, no place to turn to. Had worn out his welcome everywhere. And Kevin lived with us for a couple months. And during that time, I think realized how close he was to being without anything, you know, to being out on the streets. And of course, he was staying in, you know, what most people would consider to be a homeless shelter. And so I think it was kind of an eye-opener for him. He got a job in a different trade. He was fixing used appliances in a used appliance store in Duluth. And he did pretty well. And in time, he worked his way up to being kind of the number two person there under the owner. And are any of you from Duluth or Superior? He did pretty well, and he said to his boss, you know, I think we could open another store in Superior. Superior is a city of about 30,000 across the river from Duluth. His boss said, no, I don't think it's time. You know, I don't think we're ready for that. Kevin said, well, I'm sure we are. If you're not going to do it, I'm going to do it. And his boss said, no, you can feel free to. And he went out and decided to open a store. But he couldn't find a place that he liked in Superior, so he opened a store in a different neighborhood in Duluth, in the western part of Duluth. He did great. Within another couple years, he had opened two more stores. He's now, you know, the president, the, you know, CEO, whatever, of three little used appliance stores. He calls us now when he needs people to go to work, you know, which has been a great blessing for some of the folks that live with us. On top of that, he, you know, as I said, he's done well, he stays sober and so on, but he also sells us used appliances at a greatly reduced price and with a lifetime guarantee. So, lifetime of his company, I would guess, but at any rate, it's been great. So we have stoves, refrigerators, washers, dryers, and so on from him, which has been very nice. So those are two guys that have lived with us. I mention them first because I think a lot of us have this notion that most homeless people are alcoholic men. And, you know, early in my lifetime, and years ago in your lifetime, that was the case. That's how most homeless people were. When I grew up on the south side of Chicago, and I remember my father bringing me up to Cubs games and so on, and we'd go by Skid Row, West Madison Avenue in Chicago, just west of downtown. Old hotels, fire barrels, people living out in the streets, winos, drunks, alcoholics. That was my image of who the homeless were. And you know, largely it was true. There were a lot of single men from a variety of backgrounds, economic, social, race, and so on, religion. But that's who the homeless were. Well, nowadays, that's not so much the case. Probably about, homeless people are hard to count. Okay, I mean, you saw a figure up there of 3 million homeless people in the United States. The estimates are that in the course of a year, there are somewhere between 2 and 3 million homeless people in the United States. Okay, that's in the course of a year. So that's not at any one given night. On a given night, the estimates might be from 500,000 to 1 million. Some say even lower, some say a lot higher. You know, to be honest with you, it's pretty darn hard to count homeless people. You can count people who are staying in shelters. No problem. That's pretty easy to do. But counting people who are staying outside, who are in abandoned buildings, who are in cars, who are sleeping under freeways, are sleeping in caves, you know, on and on, very hard to count. So when people come up with these definitive numbers, whether it's the United States Census Bureau, HUD, the Coalition for the Homeless, whoever it is, it's pretty hard to say. I think most figures are a round guess, you know. But at any rate, what people say, and this is based on soup kitchen use, shelter use, and interviews and so on with low-income people, is that now about a third of our homeless people are those single men. Okay. And not all of them are alcoholics or drug addicts. Probably somewhere about a half, two-thirds would fall into that category. Where we've seen big increases in the United States of our homeless population is people who are mentally ill, people who are have mental illness chronically and don't have a support system, Many have been hospitalized, but our whole system of institutionalization has changed for people who are mentally ill, for the better in a lot of ways, but unfortunately, we don't have the support in most of our communities for these people as they come out of institutions. So a number of them, in fact, many of them, wind up in the streets of the United States. The other big number of people is families. Families, and in particular, children, are the greatest number of people increasing for homeless people in the United States. You saw a number of families in that video. Our first guest at Loaves and Fishes, when we first opened the doors, was a family, a mother with two children, fleeing domestic abuse. That probably accounts for about 50% of the women and children out on the streets today who are homeless, domestic abuse. And that family that stayed with us, a young woman with two small children, middle class, college educated, Methodist, United Church of Christ, very nice person. Any of you would be, I'm sure, glad to welcome her into your house. Most of you would have probably been glad to welcome her husband into your house. Minister, nice guy, very well educated, working on his PhD. You'd never think, peace activist, but a battery, very abusive. So we've seen, countless families. We've opened up three houses. We have a house for families, a house for single women, a house for single men. There's not as many single women out on the streets as there are men, but there are a significant amount of single women out on the streets. A fair amount of them would be women who are dealing with mental illness. It is a significant problem in their lives. But there's also alcohol and drug abuse, and as I said, domestic abuse too. So that's kind of a real quick summary of a little bit of who the homeless are. I could tell countless stories about families and single people who've lived with us over the years. I think one of the more interesting people that I lived with in D.C., we had moved there from Minnesota. And I met this fellow one morning at the shelter, and we were talking. He said, "Well, originally I'm from Minnesota." And I said, "Where?" And he said, "Houston County, Minnesota." And a little tiny county, maybe 15, 20,000 people in the county, southern Minnesota. Very close to where Angie and I had lived previously to moving to D.C. And he had been a farmer and probably third, fourth generation farmer on this 100-year-old family farm. But alcoholic, and just could not deal with kind of that pressure of being poor, homeless, and being rejected by his family in his home place. So he fled. He left Houston County. He left southeastern Minnesota and found himself in Washington, D.C. Could have found himself in Minneapolis more likely, or Chicago or Madison, but he had traveled around over the years. So what happens a lot of times is people who are fleeing or who find themselves homeless in small cities or rural areas, they just leave. There's not shelters for the most part in those little towns or rural places. There's no services, and they're embarrassed. Most homeless people aren't too happy about their plight. I've met very, very few people who want to be homeless. I know that for 8 years, President Reagan told us that people chose to be homeless. But I can tell you, I met a number of President Reagan's nearest friends, the people who lived closest to the White House. And almost none of them wanted to be homeless. This kind of notion that people choose to be homeless. I can tell you, I have met people, absolutely, that just have decided that they want to give up, kind of normal life, or the life as most of us have known it, and they want to live on the streets, they want to ride the rails, no responsibility, whatever, okay. But, tops 5%. Most everybody, given the choice of a bed, a place to stay, decent food, versus sleeping out, versus eating out of garbage cans, versus disease, versus crime, versus all those things that homeless people have to deal with every day. It's not a very hard choice. People would much rather live inside. So that's certainly been our experience. least my experience.
Just while you're on the subject of numbers and that, before you leave that, do you find a disproportionate number of homeless men are Vietnam veterans?
Well, roughly about, I would say, a third to 40% of our homeless guests or men are veterans. But it wouldn't just be Vietnam, it would be Korea, and once in a while, you know, Second World War. That's pretty rare now. But Vietnam, Korea, and then, you know, veterans from, you know, in between years, too.
My experience is definitely a disproportionate number of Vietnam.
Yeah. I mean, there clearly are a lot of Vietnam vets out there. Absolutely.
Why are they homeless in the first place? They cannot work or won't work?
The vets?
Whoever has come to your homeless place.
So just in general?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I mean, a variety of reasons. Can they work? I would say, you know, probably half or better could work. Let's say about half could work, okay? And probably we get a handful of people, 5 or 10%, who actually have jobs when they come to us, but the jobs are such that they're not making enough to be able to afford a place to live. So, for example, when a couple splits up and, you know, they go their separate ways, be it the man or the woman, they might individually not be able to, they probably can't afford the place they were renting right then. And at that time, they might not be able to afford a place on their own. When you consider security deposit, a month's rent in advance, and then that month's rent that they're paying, which is becoming more and more the norm now. So if you're talking about renting a place for $250, $300 a month, which is kind of the bottom in Minnesota anyway, you know, you might have to come up with minimum $600 and maybe, you know, $900. And people don't have that kind of money, you know, in savings. So, well, that's one problem, I think. You know, I think the other problem is that we see a lot of folks who want to work, but, you know, I mean, in our place, in Duluth, Minnesota, the economy is pretty miserable. High unemployment consistently.
I had a daughter-in-law, ex-daughter-in-law who remarried and moved there mm-hmm. a year ago, last November. Mm-hmm. She was at the University of Oregon in Eugene. She was a financial aids specialist. Mm-hmm. She's been able to find one job as a bakery clerk. And a month after she started, the bakery closed. Mm-hmm. Last month, she found a job. Now she's going to be an office manager at it's for battered women, a shelter. It's their office headquarters. Uh-huh. I mean, she's a highly skilled person with excellent references, and yeah. She's tried all this time. And she was willing to do anything.
Right.
Do the bakery clerk, work in a grocery store, do anything.
Yeah.
And this is in Duluth.
Yeah.
Fortunately, her husband has a good job.
Right. Yeah, jobs are, northeastern Minnesota is a pretty depressed area. You know, as are a number of other places in the country.
Places closed, people are laid off, and there are no more jobs.
Right, right. We live within a stone's throw of a four-lane Highway 61, you know, big highway that runs up the north shore of Lake Superior. And like any major strip like that in towns, you know, we have every fast food chain imaginable, you know, within walking distance. So people will move in with us, and they will walk up and down that street, putting in applications at Taco John's, McDonald's, Burger King, you know, and so on. And I can tell you that unless they've worked there before, they're not going to get a job. They don't even get a call back. They get nothing. You know, I mean, it's just in places like Duluth, the economy is so tight that you can't even get those kinds of jobs. You know,
because you don't have a phone.
Yeah, well, I mean, folks who are living with us, you know, at least have that. But when you're out on the streets, period, yeah, you don't have a phone, you don't have a place to shower, get clean, you know, and so on. So it's very hard, right?
I just moved into a place in Eugene because my elderly mother, 86, 87, moved in with me from the Midwest, and I had a townhouse with an upstairs and downstairs. Mm-hmm. It's a very modest little three-bedroom house. I have my 16-year-old grandson with me mm-hmm. on one level. It cost me $1,600 to get into that house, and I'm on Social Security and work part-time.
Yeah.
If my mother hadn't had savings, I couldn't have done it.
Right, yeah.
And I've worked, had a decent job all my life, you know, after my kids were grown, so.
Mm-hmm.
Their first and last month's of security deposit, and it's very modest for a home.
Right. I mean, increasingly, that is the way it is for folks. I wanted to tell you about another family. This was a family that had lived in Phoenix, and then Houston and Phoenix, and they had a teenage daughter. They had had some experiences with crime and with gangs, and they were scared of those places. And they had been listening to Paul Harvey one day. And Paul, who lives in Chicago, and vacations occasionally in and around Duluth, and you know, up the lake shore and so on, had his day, you know, his talk was about how wonderful Duluth was and how wonderful the North Shore of Minnesota was and so on. And he closed by saying, he said, you know, I'll tell you, Duluth is just this ideal place. Almost no gangs, almost no drugs, very little serious crime. You know, if you look hard, you'll find a job. It's a good place to live, you know, a good place to raise your family, good schools. I don't think he checked into the unemployment situation. I mean, he was right about most of the other stuff, you know. We don't have much drugs, we don't have much crime, compared to big cities. Okay, we're only a city of 100,000. And
do you have much ethnic diversity?
No, not too much. We have about, we have a pretty sizable Native American community. Probably about 5% of the population of Duluth, but a small African American community and a small Asian American community, and that's about it. But at any rate, we got plenty of poverty. The city's got about 25% of the people are in poverty. We got a lot of poor white people in Duluth and throughout northeastern Minnesota. But at any rate, this family heard this glowing report on Paul Harvey, and they just, you know, were kind of fed up with Phoenix. They had jobs, and they got, you know, worked a few more weeks, saved up their money, and packed up their van, sold what stuff they didn't need, and headed up to Duluth. Got to Duluth, you know, it took a while to get there. It's a long trip. And started looking for work, and they're staying in motels. You know, they ran out of money. They couldn't find jobs. So they moved into Loaves and Fishes, lived with us for probably about 3-4 weeks. And we were able to help them get into a program for families that Salvation Army runs, a transitional housing program that both helps people with housing, you know, and with getting a job. And if you need to go back to school, or, you know, you need some counseling or you need support or whatever, that they do all of those things. We have two programs like that in Duluth. One, women's transitional housing for women and children, and then Salvation Army. And they've done okay, but it took about 5 or 6 months for them to get jobs that they could have then save up some money to afford to get into housing and, you know, and so on. So that's the rest of the story. But at any rate, you know, I don't want to focus so much on Duluth, because, I mean, Duluth is one kind of scan of homelessness in the United States. You know, as I said, I did live in D.C. for a couple of years and, you know, saw a view of it there. I'm from Chicago, you know, I have a sense of what goes on there too. But I'm sure all of you have a perspective from your state.
Just the opposite of Duluth. Our county in Montana is absolutely beautiful, and you know, I hear this Paul Harvey thing, not Paul Harvey, but people come through and I say, this is beautiful, I'm going to stay here. We have a county that's 90 miles long and about 30 miles wide. It's huge.
Yeah.
There are 25,000 people. And my wife and I are the co-presidents of Food Bank in the county seat, Hamilton. And much of what you've said, we have, you know, you're talking about a city of 100,000 people. We're talking about a large rural, very rural, mountainous area.
Mm-hmm.
Problems are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And when you mentioned before living, you know, under the freeways, we have people living under the bridges, in caves. I just mentioned to Bob before you got started that once a fellow came into the food bank about a month ago, and he was looking at a tent on the riverbank. And he went back, he was looking for a job, went back to his tent, found that his whole pack was gone with his food stamps and identification and everything else. a rafter had come down, gone into his tent, stole the stuff, and, you know, it compounded his problems. He was
right.
homeless to begin with.
Right.
There are people who choose to be homeless. I remember, I know of one fellow who's a regular coming into the food bank, lives in his truck. He has it rigged up, so he's comfortable in the back. He's got a little bit of assistance income and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked at me and says, I am not homeless. he was so proud. You know, this is the way Bob chose to live.
Sure.
Another fellow by the name of Red, many years ago, was driving his Volkswagen bus, Volkswagen bug from Chicago. He worked for the Postal Service. It broke down in Hamilton. So he decided this is the place he's going to stay. Well, he found a cave in one of the canyons. He's been living in that cave for years. I have no idea where it is, and I've hiked that canyon constantly, and I climb those mountains. I have no idea where Red lives. But when I see Red, every once in a while, I'll say, Red, if you want to, you know, you want a night in a motel, or you want a meal, we can put you up, we can help you out. He says, no, I won't do it. He's got a part-time job working as a dishwasher. He saves up enough money so he can treat himself for one night in a motel each month.
Mm-hmm.
He's neat, he's clean, he's articulate. He chooses to live in some shelter or a cave somewhere on the canyon.
Yeah.
Your story about people coming through Duluth running out of money. This is typical in our area.
Everywhere, I think.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
People come from the southeast, they're heading for Alaska, they run out of money in Hamilton, Montana. What are they going to do? Families.
Yeah.
They live in their vans, in their buses, whatever.
Yeah.
We have an extremely high homeless rate in the summertime, the transients.
Right.
They're drifting through.
Same with us.
In the wintertime, the population drops mainly because of the weather.
Mm-hmm.
Women with children. You said the same thing that I would say, that we're seeing the same types of people, but we're in a very, very rural area.
Right.
And our problem is people come through and say, I like it here, I'm going to stay. And I look them in the eye and say, we're 45 miles from Missoula, they have a homeless shelter. We can't afford it. We investigated. We cannot afford to put up a homeless shelter in Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not. The money will not, it won't equate out.
Mm-hmm.
So we sent them to Missoula where there is a homeless shelter, or we tried to.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, I'm going to make it here. Very few of them do. The rest of them we see over and over again, living in the campgrounds, in their cars. And that type of thing, but they're going to get jobs. They swear up and down.
Mm-hmm.
There's no housing. But we are, our rentals are between 0 and 1% availability
mm-hmm.
where we are.
Right.
You probably have more rentals available.
Our low-income rentals are somewhere around 3%.
Yeah, that's so much higher than what
yeah.
we have.
But still, you know, yeah. it's very low, right? Yeah, I mean, that's a good example. And I think, you know, just a couple themes that you point out is that one, you know, things have changed dramatically, I think, in the last 30 years. For example, you know, in some of your days, and I can remember this, labor pools, day labor pools. Duluth used to have 2-day labor pools where people could go down and find a job every day. They're both gone. There's no day labor pools anymore. Minneapolis still has a day labor pool. But, you know, that's a city of, you know, of a couple million people, Minneapolis, St. Paul.
We do have some of that.
Well, sure, we have some day labor, but the pools are gone. You know, I mean,
yeah.
You can't go anyplace. You can go to the job service now and maybe get a day labor position.
And all our jobs are minimum wage, mm-hmm. every one.
Yeah.
And even the people who have a place to live can't live without assistance, food stamps, and they're working hard.
Right.
I know that they are working hard.
Yeah.
Married couples with kids,
mm-hmm.
They're working.
Right.
And they can't make it.
I have a concern. I teach small children, and I see it. I see people coming through with needing to go from one hotel mm-hmm. to another because the rent there is less. And parents pulling their kids out of school because they've lost their jobs and they're going to state parks. Behind the park where we play, there's a hedge, and the kids, I tell them not to go back there because there are people who are sleeping there,
mm-hmm.
so that's their home, even though, you know, they let them be there. I know that in Oregon they're trying to clear the parks of people who are staying in homeless shelters, or well, you're making that their camp. I'm thinking, where are people supposed to go? I mean, instead of just, you know, giving out horror stories, what is the solution for where people are supposed to go? There's, I don't know, you're obviously probably in the places where you are.
I got some ideas.
Okay.
Yeah. No, we're doing some stuff. I think, you know, maybe we've talked enough about the problem. I mean, I guess we all acknowledge that it is a significant problem. And I think, you know, the thing that's interesting, I mean, you know, I wasn't alive in the 30s, and a couple of you were, but homelessness was a big thing in the 30s. There was a lot of people out on the streets. And, you know, I've talked to my parents and my grandparents about this. But it kind of ended, you know. Homelessness kind of ended. There's always been homeless people. I mean, since the beginning of time, you know, I think of Cain as the first homeless person, right? But there's always been times in our society, in our American society, and then if you are to look at the Western society, when there's been little blurbs when a lot of people were out on the streets or a lot of people were without, and then society said, you know, we're going to take care of this, and they did, you know, and things got better. And we didn't see that many people out on the streets. But this current time of homelessness started probably in the very early 1980s. And it was not, it's not any one factor. It wasn't just President Reagan. It wasn't just that Congress. You know, it wasn't just President Reagan that cut the housing budget 75%. It was the Democratic Congress at that time. So, you know, it's not, homelessness is not a partisan issue. Okay, both the parties are very guilty of doing some really bad things, bad policy. But I think now, in the 90s, where we've had this problem for the last 12, 13, 14 years, I can't say that things are getting better, but they don't seem to be getting any worse. We seem to have hit kind of a plateau where we've got this large, somewhat stable number, somewhat stable, but ever-changing. You know, it's not like the same people are homeless all the time, okay? I mean, we certainly see that. There's a group of people, chronic alcoholics, people who are suffering serious mental illness. They might be homeless for the rest of their lives. But most of the families we see, you know, we don't ever see them again. You know, and most of the single women that we see and single men that don't have mental health or chemical dependency problems, we don't ever see them again. You know, they get jobs, they get their life back together, but then somebody else slips and falls. And so there's some big things happening, some big institutional things happening. One of them we've alluded to with our whole economy. We're not creating jobs for people who have minimum skills, okay? I mean, we're not creating jobs for people who have some skills. But in what jobs we're creating, at the bottom, Duluth is a big tourism place. They're all minimum wage, just like you were saying, okay? They're all minimum wage. The minimum wage, if you were to keep track of inflation over the last 20 years, has lost ground about 25%, okay? So if you were to go back to the 1970s, get the dollar there and calculate that through, we've lost about 25% of the value of minimum wage, okay? But housing in the United States at the same time, rental housing we're talking about now, has increased about 100+%. You know, and in some places, a couple 100%. So you're making a little bit less, but you got to spend a lot more for housing, okay? And home ownership, you know, by the way, is going up too, of course. But that's not an option really for most people who are low income. So, I mean, you know, there's a handful of people that benefit from Habitat and other programs like that. But for most folks, it's rent and that's it. That's their only option. So the second factor is our rental market for low-income housing has largely shrunk dramatically. And there's a few factors there. One, I mentioned that during the 1980s, the Reagan administration and the Congress cut the federal housing budget about 75%. Roughly from about $30 billion a year to about $7.5 billion a year. Now that is starting to go back up. It went up a little bit during the Bush years, and now it's going up more quickly under the Clinton administration. But it's still, you know, we're going to be at about $18 or $19 billion this year. So we're not back to where we were in 1980. We got more people, we got a lot more poor people. As a matter of fact, I mean, just to give you you know, some figures on that. In 1980, we had about 25 million people in the country living below poverty level. Poverty level for a family of four is about $15,000, okay? So 25 million people in that spot in 1980. By 1992, we had 37 million. 37 million. So we've increased dramatically over those 12 years. And at the same time, while housing costs have gone up, people's incomes in real dollars have gone down, we have not been building low-income housing. When the federal government said in the 1980s, we're not going to build any more housing, that's basically what they said. We're not going to build any more housing. So many of you are blessed with senior citizen housing in your towns, right? High rises in some places, apartment buildings in others, okay? When those seniors moved out of the apartments they were in and they moved out of the houses that they owned, that freed it up for other people, right? That freed it up for families to move into those houses or apartments or single people.
Places there's waiting lists or anything that's subsidized.
Right, because we stopped building them. The United States stopped building those places. They stopped building, you know, we can say all the bad things we want about public housing in the United States, and there's plenty of bad things to say about it. But it is better than being homeless, by and large. And I grew up in Chicago. There's a few places in Chicago that need to just be leveled, absolutely. But, you know, I can say in Duluth, for example, the public housing is not bad. It is not bad. And it's a heck of a lot better than being homeless. Heck of a lot better. And frankly, it's better than most of the low-income rental private property in town. Because that doesn't meet code. The public housing in Duluth meets code, by and large. So, at any rate, we've stopped building that. And do you think that the private sector would go out and build low-income housing? No, and I'm not being unfair to them. I mean, if you're a home builder or an apartment builder, are you going to build low-income apartments when you can build middle-income apartments or upper-income apartments? No, you know, I mean, why would you build a place that you could charge, you know, $400 a month of rent to a family, a two- or three-bedroom, when you could build a similar place for not a heck of a lot more and charge $600 or $800 or $1,000 a month rent? So the private industry, they're not building low-income housing. And by and large, with the exception of a few tax credit packages, you know, there's no incentive for them to do that. I mean, I'm not condemning them as much. You know, they're not in business to do good. They're in business to make money, right? So it's just not happening. The only sector in the United States that has shown tremendous growth in building housing is the nonprofit sector. And that includes churches and church-based kinds of organizations that build housing, and private nonprofit organizations.
Don't you think that's better than public housing?
Yes, it is. But unfortunately, at this point, they can't keep. They're not even keeping up with the demand that's here today.
But I saw public housing in Washington D.C. 25 years ago, where they wiped out the urban areas and they said, we're going to build low-cost housing.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to give an incentive to the private industry to do this.
Right.
Consequently, the poor people never got in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they build low-cost housing for the president, the vice president of the United States, and people like that.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of horror stories like that out there, absolutely. You know, we've leveled miles and miles of inner city neighborhood promising to rebuild housing and not doing it.
Well, we're running into another problem that is universal. It's not in my backyard.
Right.
And when we, and I got on the low-income housing task force in Hamilton, in Mirabella County in Montana, thinking that, you know, this is going to be something where we just started about 6-8 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm off already. I can't cope with them because they keep talking about affordable housing. And we do have one builder that's ethical and he desires, he really wants to get into the low income business and do a reasonable job doing this.
Mm-hmm.
He came up with a figure that they can't build houses for any less than $80,000 to $85,000 per unit. And at about that time, I totally lost interest.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, that's not affordable for our poor friends.
Right. Okay?
There's just no way they can touch that.
Right.
I also work very closely with the Human Resource Council that serves a three-county area. with a multi-million-dollar budget, including Missoula. And when property becomes available, it is very painful to see what you have to go through to try to get that property. See that it's served by sewer and water, and then as soon as the neighbors find out, you're going to put up a number of units, smaller units, moderate income,
right.
Not even low income.
Right.
It's not in my backyard.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very frustrating thing where we are. We want to do it. It's the greatest thing in the world. There are government grants available. We can put up subsidized housing units. We can get rentals for people to pay $300 subsidized, up to $450.
Right. Yep.
They subsidize the remainder. But every time we turn around, there's a barrier. And as you said, Michael, the best way to go, obviously, is the private
nonprofit.
But the capital isn't there.
No.
There's just nobody who has that kind of money.
I would like, we only got a few minutes left. I'd like to talk to you about that, and maybe we can have dinner together. Because we're doing it in Duluth. We are building units. Okay. And we are running up against NIMBY. There's no doubt about it. I worked for the last year and a half to convert a closed elementary school into apartments for families. We had a private developer, and this guy is a classy, good, very wealthy individual that said, it's time for me to pay back. I've made a lot of money. I've built a lot of houses in town. I'm ready to build some low-income apartments. And he liked this idea of converting this old school into housing, classy old school, And we got an architect that was great. We raised about $750,000 raised. This was going to be about $60,000 a unit.
Okay.
This is for an existing building.
And that's pretty expensive.
Well, I know. I can tell you. Believe me, I don't know where the money goes. But, when you cure the asbestos, you deal with the lead paint, all the various health and safety stuff that everybody wants and should have, right? Poor people shouldn't have to deal with that, live with that stuff. But you got to do that stuff, right? So when you've done all that, that's what you're going to pay. $60,000 a unit. These were 2 and 3 bedroom apartments.
That's rehab. And we're looking into some rehab, and the costs are just unbelievable, even with a government grant.
Yeah. But at any rate, my point is, it can be done. Now, in this case, we lost because of NIMBY. The neighbors beat us. But we got two other projects going on right now where we have defeated the NIMBY folks. And I'll tell you, NIMBY, this is not in my backyard. To me, it's the antithesis of Christianity. If we're concerned about living the gospel, if we're concerned about Matthew 25, and when Christ is a stranger, we welcome into our home or we welcome into our neighborhood, then we have got, not only can't we be NIMBY, we got to be opposed to NIMBY. We got to be out there fighting it. I'm sure all of you would have examples of this, but people tried to build a group home for people with Alzheimer's. Neighbors said no. I could go on and on with horror stories like that, but you've heard them, and they're out there.
They're supported somewhere else, but you was thinking about property values.
Right. And that property values thing, is really a ruse. There is no real truth in that.
Many of these people, once they are able to own something of their very own, they are so proud, so proud that they keep good. They keep their homes in good condition, immaculate yards, and so on.
Right.
Very few of those housing areas that are owned by the residents are in bad shape.
Yeah.
They're proud owners.
Right.
They've never owned anything before.
Do you want me to explain to you part of what,
sure.
what I mean? And I absolutely agree with your point of view, but I do understand it because I work with children in a low-income area. I see some kids that are no longer living maybe with their original parent. They're living now with a grandparent, but the original parent happened to use drugs when the child was in the womb. And so you get, when you have low, real low-income children living with people who are aspiring to the middle class, They get real upset when their children come home swearing and their kids come home with being beaten up and all that. I mean,
sure.
That's a real issue.
Right.
I think that even those middle class people want to be good about it, but the truth of it is, it ends up being class warfare, even not race warfare, but really class
sure.
warfare in terms of people with different values sharing the same space.
I think you've hit something there. What we've done, and we're doing more and more in our society, in the United States here, is all the low-income people are living in pockets and neighborhoods. And you know, if you're in a big city, it's probably by race. But I can tell you in Duluth, where most people are white, all the poor people, and they're mostly white, are living in a few neighborhoods. And most all of the low-income housing over the years has been built in those neighborhoods, right? So the phenomenon that you're talking about, where all the broken homes, all the families that are dysfunctional, all the people that have got problems, they're all living in the same neighborhood. Most all the group homes, right? And there's something both anti-Christian about that, I think, and it's not healthy for a society. And I mean, unless we're going to build big walls around all the other neighborhoods, things aren't going to work. It's interesting because those of us who espouse kind of middle-class values and Christian values would think that we would want to share those values with people who don't have them, okay, or allegedly don't have them, or who want them but don't have them yet.
Well, we do. We give money.
We don't give very much, Michael. But anyway, interesting study. In Chicago, the Gautreau court decision back in the 1960s, public housing in Chicago said that X amount of units of public housing had to be built out of the inner city. Now, this was a racial thing, okay? All the public housing that was built in Chicago in the inner city, Robert Taylor homes up and down the south side, for example, almost all of that was occupied by black folks, okay? And it became very clear that all that public housing was segregated, in a sense. You know, everybody was black there, and black folks did not have an opportunity to live anyplace else in the city, almost. And they had almost no opportunity to live anywhere in the suburbs. Chicago is a metropolitan area of about 7 million people, okay? About half of those people are out in the suburbs, about half in the city, a little less than half in the cities. So this court ruling said that from now on in public housing, back in the 60s, you got to start putting folks who are going to be in public housing, who are going to be destined for these inner city neighborhoods, you got to start putting them out in the suburbs. You got to spread them out all over, okay? Well, a teacher at Northwestern University decided that he was going to study that. And he has studied almost every person that has been placed outside. And then he has a control group, a group of people who weren't placed outside, who, you know, wound up in public housing at the same time. Those people, as you might expect, okay, one, those neighborhoods where they moved to, because they would be like a person on a block, and there wouldn't be another person on the next block either, okay? So they had a hard time their first year or two, okay? They were the only black person in that neighborhood, okay? They were probably the only poor person in that neighborhood. But you know what? As you might guess, those middle-class values, that middle-class environment, those middle-class schools, those jobs in those suburbs paid off for those people because they finished school. Their kids finished school. Their kids went on to college. Their kids had jobs. They got jobs. They went off welfare. Incredible proportions greater than that control group of people that stayed in the city, okay? So, I mean, that's just an example, but that's a long study. That's gone on over the last 20-some years that has clearly shown that if people are given the opportunity to live in healthy, prosperous environments, and I'm not talking about rich neighborhoods. I'm talking about middle-class suburbs, okay? They've done well. They've done very well. They haven't organized gangs in those suburbs. Because, you know, we're not talking about thousands of people moving out into, you know, this suburb or that suburb, okay? We're talking about a family here, a family there, a family here. And that's the kind of system that we need to try to incorporate. Habitat for Humanity tries to do that kind of work. They run into that same NIMBY, you know, that same not in my backyard. They can buy a lot in the inner city, no problem, right? But inner city people are happy to see a new house being built, right? Actually, their property values are going to go up. But you try to build that same nice house in, you know, a nice neighborhood, in a middle-class neighborhood, people are going to raise hell. This is a Christian organization. Christian people building these houses. And you know those neighborhoods are largely Christian people, right? They're church-going people. I know they are in Duluth. You know, I'm sure they are in Chicago. So NIMBY is certainly a big problem that we have to grapple with and deal with. You know, and I just think the gospel is so clear of where we should be as Christians. I think last and closing, I just want to say that churches can have a tremendous impact on this. Where we have done best in our NIMBY fights, we have gotten the churches in those neighborhoods where we had opposition to publicly say, we are for this housing. And we've had people quit those churches. You know, pastors have said, you know, I lost a few parishioners this week. And they feel bad about it. You know, and I don't blame them. But all they are is speaking the gospel, you know, pure and simple. Those people went to another church. But my point is, if we could get people, churches, to say, yes, we need housing for everybody. We need low-income housing. We need moderate-income housing. We need racial diversity. And we welcome these people in our neighborhood, just like we welcome refugees. You know, we welcome in families from all over the world. And not that they don't, they have it easy, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that. But you know, churches will sponsor families from Southeast Asia. And then you turn around and say, we want to build some low-income housing in your neighborhood. And they can't believe it. No way. I mean, it boggles the mind, I think, you know. But at any rate, there are there's some progress happening. And I will say that the nonprofit sector right now seems to be the direction where low-income housing is being most successful. Small organizations, some affiliated with churches, some Christian, and there's Jewish ones and there's Muslim ones and so on, but most of them are Christian, or just private, non-secular groups. There's this great Lutheran church in Michigan City, Indiana. Michigan City is a little town about 40 miles east of Chicago on Lake Michigan. And what they did is they had a bunch of vacant land next to their church that I don't know what they were going to do with it. I think sell it for development. And they decided that they would build a senior citizen apartment building there. It's right on the other side of the parking lot. And they built it, and it was a gamble. You know, they had to go out and raise that money and so on. They had some not-in-my-backyard people say, no, we don't want low-income seniors. People say that, you know. But they built it, and it's a mixed thing. It's low, moderate, and middle-income seniors. You know, they have some services there. And it's great because you don't have to be Lutheran to live there. But, you know, a lot of the folks are Lutheran that live there. These folks can walk right to church. You know, it's a great ministry to people. They have a lot of programs in the building and so on. And again, as those people moved out of their houses and apartments, that freed up some of that housing for other people, okay? And there have actually been programs where churches have then paired low and moderate income people in their churches with those kinds of projects. You know, so as the seniors move out of their house or apartment, somebody from the church who is having a hard time finding a house that they can afford or finding a decent apartment moves into that apartment or house. If we could all get our churches to do that kind of stuff, we'd be way ahead. So. Other questions? Thoughts? I'm going to be around, you know, through this week. And you can't tackle this whole thing in an hour, obviously. But there are a lot of really good, positive things going on out there. I will say this, you know, I'm committed to action. You know, we talk a lot at Holden, you know, we learn a lot, but if we don't do something with it, it's really worthless. In fact, I would say it's less than worthless. It's counterproductive. So I'm going to give each of you a piece of paper and an envelope. And you might just consider writing your U.S. Senator, your Congressperson, and say, we'd like to see more money spent on housing. We'd like to see more money spent on the homeless. The biggest housing subsidy in the United States, who knows what the biggest housing subsidy in the United States is? Most of you have used it.
Income tax for homeowners.
Right. We deduct the mortgage interest on our income tax, right? It's about $70 billion a year. That's the biggest housing subsidy, and it always has been since it came in the 1950s. You know, it was a pretty healthy thing, right? It gave people an opportunity to own their own house at a more affordable rate, right? It was a good social policy that the Truman administration put together. But that's the biggest housing subsidy, okay? And it largely helps middle and upper income people. Because low-income people don't have that much income tax to write off, frankly, and they can't afford to buy houses. So if you hear people complaining about low-income housing, subsidized housing, remind them that they're the beneficiaries of the biggest housing subsidy in the United States. And it's one that's worked. You know, when folks came back, those soldiers came back from World War II, it put a lot of people to work building houses, right? And then it put a lot of families in decent houses. That's great. I mean, that's what we would like for everybody.